Welcome to Public Health Out Loud, public health for the public. My name is Dr. Philip Chan from the Rhode Island Department of Health, and today we are talking about ticks. After a mild winter, we are seeing more ticks than usual, which have survived into the spring. Because of this, the Rhode Island Department of Health and Department of Environmental Management has warned Rhode Islanders that this year could be especially bad for the transmission of Lyme disease and other tick-borne diseases. So what do you need to know about ticks, and how can you minimize your risk of being bitten? Our guest today is an expert on the diseases that ticks carry. He is a personal colleague and mentor of mine. He is board certified in internal medicine and pediatrics, as well as in adult infectious diseases. Dr. Jerry Larkin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Phil. Glad to be here.
Dr. Larkin, tell us who you are and where you're from and what do you do?
So I work at mostly Rhode Island Hospital and Merriam Hospital. I'm on the faculty at Brown. I had the privilege of growing up in Connecticut, the home of Lyme disease, or where it was first described. I'm a New Englander by birth and residence now.
So you take care of a lot of folks with tick-borne diseases like Lyme. And this time of year, we hear about ticks. Tell us, just in basic terms, what exactly is a tick and why do we care so much?
So ticks, if they did not cause as much human disease as they do, are a little bit to be admired. They're more like spiders than they are insects. They're arachnids, and they are very evolved to their specific environment, meaning that if you go to one part of the world, that ticks in that part of the world will be, again, very evolved towards that particular area. So in Rhode Island, we have what are predominantly the Ixodes tick, so Ixodes scapularis, that can cause Lyme disease, something called babesiosis, and something called anaplasmosis. But in other parts of the world, there are different diseases caused by different ticks. And usually there's something inside the tick. It's not the tick itself that causes disease, at least in most cases, but rather some parasite or bacterium or even virus that is infecting the tick itself that will then potentially be transmitted to a human and cause human disease.
And how big are ticks and where do you find them? Are they, you know, are they on our lawns? Are they only in like wooded areas? Where are people most likely to get ticks?
So the ticks that, again, the Ixodes scapularis tick that lives in Rhode Island and causes Lyme disease can be very, very different sizes. A tick goes through three stages in their life cycle. They have something called a larva, which is tiny, the size of a poppy seed. They go then through a nymph phase that's a little bit bigger, a little bit more identified, and then the adult usually is visible to us just looking at it. And that still, though, is, you know, maybe the size of the point of a pencil, or if it's the female, or it's now engorged after having bitten or fed on a mammal, maybe a little bit bigger, so like the eraser. They're found really everywhere. However, they are predominantly in what is called the leaf litter. So if you go to the edges of your yard, there may be leaves that you raked there that are decomposing, or you take a walk in the woods. That's where they predominantly are, but they really can be on any kind of vegetation, and they can be on any of the mammals that they potentially feed on. The white-footed mouse is the sort of natural reservoir in the northeast of the United States. And usually it is the larvae that are feeding on the white-footed mouse. And then the nymphs and the adults may then jump to other species of animals such as dogs, occasionally cats, although they don't seem to like cats as much. And cats don't seem to be a very competent vector for the bacteria that tick can transmit. And then, you know, classically the deer or other mammals and us humans.
And as you mentioned before, one of the biggest diseases that ticks transmit is Lyme disease. And so in 2022, for example, there were over 2,300 cases of Lyme disease in the state of Rhode Island. And this was compared to 980 cases in 2021. So we are seeing an increase, potentially due to global warming, potentially due to some of the more milder winters we've been having. But Dr. Larkin, talk to us about Lyme disease. Why do we care about Lyme disease? Why is this the one that we hear about? And Maybe what are the signs and symptoms of Lyme?
So why do we care about Lyme disease? Because it can make you feel pretty bad, particularly in its early stages or in the initial infection. It is sort of like having the flu, although usually you have the flu in the winter, but in Lyme disease, you usually have it in the late spring through the summer and into the early fall. And then once there's been a couple of hard frosts in the fall, the ticks tend to then become more dormant. So you don't see a lot of new infections, although you may not present with infection until later in the fall as well. If the person is not treated or the disease is not recognized in its early stage, it is possible for people to go on to have more chronic manifestations of it. Probably the most serious one being abnormalities with the heart rhythm that can happen. And then sometimes people will develop swelling and inflammation in their joints, typically the knee. But to get back to the first, you know, stages of Lyme disease, early on in the infection, usually sometimes days or maybe a couple weeks after the infection, people will have a lot of systemic symptoms. What I mean by that is they may have a lot of joint pain, they'll have fever, they'll have headaches. Almost everybody who has acute Lyme disease will have a headache and just feeling pretty lousy. One of the things they rarely have, however, are gastrointestinal symptoms, although their appetite may be a little bit off. You're not going to get diarrhea or nausea and vomiting from Lyme disease. And you don't usually get respiratory symptoms. So you're not going to get a runny nose or a sore throat or chest congestion from Lyme disease. So if you have those things, it's going to be something else, even in the summer. But all of those other symptoms, people feel pretty lousy. They feel like they've kind of been knocked down a flight of stairs or something. And they will usually be recognized as having something there. And then if they see a physician, they may, or another provider, they'll get diagnosed and get treated. But it's really the later consequences of Lyme disease that we are probably more concerned about because of that arthritis, the potential issues with the heart rhythm. And then there are some people who have more chronic fatigue-like symptoms as well.
Yeah. And I often think that here in Rhode Island, given that we're one of the hot spots of Lyme disease in the U.S., that there's probably many people that have had Lyme disease and haven't known it. I mean, do you have a sense of how many people actually have symptoms or how many people seek care? I mean, I have to believe that the 2,000 cases that we have diagnosed in Rhode Island in 2022, that's probably just the tip of the iceberg. How many people do you suspect may have had Lyme disease and, you know, either been asymptomatic, no symptoms, or just blew it off and not gone to see a doctor?
Yeah, that's a tough question to answer because oftentimes what happens is people will go to the doctor because they feel so lousy, particularly if it's a child, they may get diagnosed with an ear infection or some sort of infection. And the doctor may not be completely accurate in terms of what their diagnosis is. But if they use some of the commonly prescribed antibiotics for other types of infections, such as ear infections, then you may actually have Lyme disease and get treated. So that's,
great point.
You know, one of the reasons why it's really hard to understand exactly how many people may get Lyme disease in any given year or not. So most people, again, if they feel lousy, will kind of, you know, sort of be looking at themselves and sort of saying, well, is something going on with my joint, my knee really hurts a lot. And what they may see is something called the erythema migrans rash. So that is an area where usually the tick actually has bitten the person. You will get an area of redness that will eventually start to expand and then clear in the middle. So that's why it's called a bullseye looking rash. And about 80% of people who are diagnosed with Lyme disease report at some point or another having had that erythema migrans rash. And that's kind of the classic finding to make a physician or nurse practitioner or physician's assistant sort of suspect that Lyme disease is present. That is actually a sufficient finding to make the diagnosis. And if the first time that the erythema migrans rash is there where the tick is actually bitten and inoculated, the bacteria resolves on its own, which in a fair number of people it may, then you can get sort of what's called early disseminated disease, where you'll have multiple sites of that erythema migrans rash. Again, sort of an area that starts off as a little bit of redness, flat on the skin, not with blisters, not with a sandpapery feel or anything like that, really just some redness of the skin. It may have some pain or itchiness or other types of symptoms around the area. But then again, it sort of starts to expand and clears in the middle. Not every single person who has a skin manifestation will have that erythema migrans rash, as I mentioned. About 80% of people will. The other 20%, the rash may look somewhat different. Sometimes it will look a little bit like a scab or maybe even a blister, but that's somewhat atypical.
Dr. Larkin, how do you treat Lyme disease? Is it difficult to treat?
The early disease or the early disseminated disease. So if you just have that, you know, single erythema migrans rash or early disseminated disease where you may have many manifestations of the erythema migrans or some other symptoms. So again, the joint aches and pains, the headache, sometimes even a meningitis, which is a scary word, but generally speaking, meningitis from Lyme disease is a relatively indolent process. So the people don't feel good for sure, but they don't get catastrophically ill as you may see with other forms of meningitis. Those all can be treated relatively easily with either doxycycline, amoxicillin, penicillin, or some other antibiotics in a class called cephalosporins. And most people, when they're diagnosed in that early phase of either early disease or early disseminated disease, respond fairly promptly to the antibiotics. What is also notable, though, is that as opposed to a lot of other illnesses where people usually will respond fairly quickly to antibiotics for, say, strep throat or an ear infection, and their symptoms will resolve within a day or two. While that can be oftentimes true of Lyme disease, there's a fairly significant number of people, probably a minority, but still a significant number of people who will remain symptomatic for, you know, a few weeks, even after the antibiotics have stopped. The good news is that while that may be unpleasant, most people will respond with resolution of their symptoms over the course of, you know, those several weeks or so. It is not usually needed to retreat them. Their body needs to take care of itself. The inflammatory response needs to calm down a little bit. The later forms of Lyme disease, such as the arthritis or the heart rhythm issues, is also relatively easily treated, but can get a little bit more involved. And that sometimes people require IV antibiotics or prolonged courses of treatment, or in some instances, particularly with the arthritis, they may need to be treated a few times before you start to see a resolution of their symptoms.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I think the other thing too that comes up related to this is that some people have persistent symptoms related to Lyme disease and so-called chronic Lyme disease. Can you talk a little bit about what chronic Lyme disease is and how we should think about treating it?
So there really are two entities you want to think about. One is something that we often have referred to as post-treatment Lyme disease, and that we try and define fairly specifically, and that a person has had a reliable diagnosis, meaning that they've either had a blood test or, again, that erythema migrans rash. They've been treated adequately with a course of doxycycline or amoxicillin. And then sometime in the first 6 months or so after that diagnosis, they have the onset of more chronic persistent symptoms. Usually, again, it's going to be fatigue, maybe some joint pain, not necessarily arthritis. And what I mean by that is you don't really have swelling and redness of the joint or the warmth in the joint. You just have sort of joint pain, and then sometimes even some neurologic symptoms. Those can be chronic pain type symptoms in some of the nerve distributions of the arms or the legs, or it can actually be more of a difficulty with concentration or executive function. So decision-making, organizational, that sometimes people refer to as sort of brain fog. Couple things about that. One is it's still very difficult to rigorously study it. Part of the reason why we've tried to give it a more precise definition is so that we can study it. The second is that while you may at some point with your physician or provider decide that you're going to prescribe a course of antibiotics, whether it be doxycycline or sometimes IV antibiotics, once you've been treated with one of the recommended regimens, which is usually, again, either doxycycline or ceftriaxone for about 4 weeks, additional antibiotics are not helpful. You may get some benefit from that course in terms of resolution of your symptoms, but when we have studied this process fairly rigorously and tried to see, will more antibiotics after that help? The answer is it really does not. So if the antibiotics have not made your symptoms go away, the answer is not more antibiotics. A tougher group of people have something more colloquially referred to as chronic Lyme disease. So, and it's harder to sort of understand where they are. There are people who are very symptomatic, again, usually with fatigue and joint aches and pains, but they may or may not ever have had a diagnosis of Lyme disease. They may or may not have evidence of Lyme disease in the past on a blood test. And they, while very symptomatic, it's not really clear what they're actually suffering from. And that's, you know, kind of one of the big challenges for the patient, as well as for, I guess, medicine, you know, capital M as a profession, is what's going on with those people. An important aspect of that is you want to make sure that you have not missed some other diagnosis. And occasionally we'll have patients who actually have rheumatoid arthritis or may have chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia. Had a couple patients who we've actually wound up diagnosing with hepatitis C, which can be, you know, fairly silent or not very specific in its presentation. So you want to make sure that, you know, other things have been ruled out, and that maybe, particularly if you have more prominent joint findings, that you have an evaluation by a rheumatologist. If the symptoms are more neurologic, particularly if it's the more sort of thought processes, you want to try and make a very rigorous diagnosis through neuropsychiatric testing. You meet with a professional, usually a psychologist, who goes through a lot of tests with you to sort of see if we can isolate what is exactly the domain, what exactly is the part of your thinking, for want of a better term, that seems to be problematic. And then based on that, hopefully you can work with a psychologist or other people to try and sort of figure out what to do about that. Again, the answer there is not going to be more antibiotics. It's more trying to address the, you know, the very precise thought process that is impaired. And I suppose there's also, you know, the possibility that there may be, you know, many other types of neurologic or maybe even psychiatric illnesses that you want to make sure that you're not missing. Is the person depressed, or is the person, but it's also possible that the person is depressed because they are so symptomatic. Mm-hmm. So again, it's really having a pretty detailed discussion with your primary care doctor and then deciding, well, how do we approach the part of things that is troubling you the most, and what is there available that we can do about it?
Yeah. Dr. Larkin, let me ask you a philosophical question here. You know, we've spent a lot of time on this podcast and other outlets talking about long COVID. And I think, you know, just as you're talking, I'm wondering, you know, that really has drawn attention to some of these post-infectious sequelae, right, of some of these infections, of virus, bacteria, others. I'm just wondering, and you know, we see it not just in COVID, you know, we're talking about Lyme today, we see it in influenza, the flu. I'm just wondering if you think that there's a common thread that connects some of these post-infectious, you know, syndromes together, or if they're different, and really if any infection could cause something like this. You know, we've heard a lot with long COVID about brain fog, and obviously, you know, SARS-CoV-2, COVID is more respiratory, and so we see some post COVID type respiratory complaints. But I'm just wondering in general, is there a common thread here between these infections? Is it an immune response, inflammatory? Just wondering your thoughts based on experiences and treating really a large array of infections.
Yeah, that's a really excellent question, and one that I sort of was thinking about as I was giving the last answer. I think the answer is there is a common thread, but the thread is somewhere in a haystack, to mix my metaphors. And no one fully understands what that thread is. I think for a lot of us, myself in particular, you know, included, is that the phenomenon of long COVID has actually helped me understand Lyme disease and some of the more chronic manifestations somewhat better. And I think that's part of what I was getting at with, you know, trying to isolate, well, what is the symptom? What is the patient experiencing, whether it be Lyme disease or long COVID? We don't have a lot of therapeutics for the bacteria or the virus itself in those cases, or, you know, we have therapeutics and we've offered them and they have done their job, but there is a sequelae of the infection itself that probably has to do with some sort of immune reactivation or sort of cross-reacting antibodies where the antibodies that the immune system has produced against the infection also winds up attacking your own tissue. And that's probably best worked out in the instance of the arthritis. It's clear that there are, you know, molecules in the joint that are similar enough to the molecules in the spirochete, the bacteria that causes Lyme disease, that you can actually develop antibodies against those tissues in the joint. And that's probably what makes some of that, you know, that's probably what drives some of that pain process. But it's a, you know, it's a very interesting area, but it's one where there are probably way more questions than there are answers right now. But again, I think that model of isolating what is the patient experiencing. So in long COVID, I think what most of us have been working on is, okay, if the symptoms are primarily respiratory, make sure there's nothing else going on in your lung. Are there things that can be treated? Can we treat the wheezing? Can we treat the, you know, the spasm in the bronchioles? Or is there something going on with your heart? Is there, you know, because certainly COVID has a propensity to attack the heart tissue as well. And so is there something, you know, that we can do to make your heart function better? We need to make sure that it is functioning okay with something called an echocardiogram, which is basically an ultrasound of the heart to see what its function is like. Or again, is it the neurocognitive things? Is it the patient's issues with thinking and sort of alertness that are the issue? The good thing about both entities is that patients who do have those symptoms, whether it's the post-treatment Lyme disease or long COVID, I think the patient, you know, remaining optimistic is extremely important because many people do get better. If you look at them, and you have to take a somewhat longer view of it, you have to sort of say, how did I feel on the day that I first had Lyme disease? How did I feel 2 months after having Lyme disease, 6 months, a year? And usually if you get out to that year point, people are going to notice that there's an actual different, an appreciable improvement compared to where they were at time zero or 1 month or 6 months or what have you. And I think that's very true of people with long COVID as well. And then the other thing is, again, focusing on what the patient is experiencing. Certainly graded exercise programs, working with a physiatrist, which is a doctor that specializes in functionality, potentially physical therapists or occupational therapists, making sure that you're observing good sleep hygiene. Sometimes that requires medical interventions of some sort, you know, medications that can help with sleep. And then non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications like Motrin or Naprosyn or even plain Tylenol can sometimes help. Mm-hmm.
And I guess, too, I'm reassured that, and just to reassure people that may be suffering from these conditions, is that there's lots of funding going into studying these, as you mentioned, just a lack of data, both long COVID as well as chronic Lyme, and frankly, other post-infectious conditions. A lot of attention by the NIH, by others, trying to find good treatment. So I think, to your point, you know, a lot to learn. You know, check in with your provider and they can go from there. Dr. Larkin, we're starting to wind down here, but one last question for you just in general. You know, we often talk about prevention being the best medicine. How do we prevent tick bites? And I know here at the health department, we often tell folks to repel, check, and remove, but tell us the best ways just in terms of preventing tick-borne infections in general.
Prevention, you know, certainly, one thing you can do is use a permethrin or a DEET-containing insect repellent. So DEET you can use on the skin. Permethrin you can use on clothing. It is deactivated by the oil on human skin, but you can get preparations from camping goods stores or outdoor activity stores that the permethrin is, you can lay out your clothing, spray it on, let the permethrin dry, and that will actually work through, you know, several washings. So if you're, you know, if you want to go through that type of a process, it's certainly something you could do at the beginning of the spring or summer, or maybe do it a couple other times. So that's one method of preventing tick bites. Another is be sure to wear long sleeves and pants, tuck your pants into your socks if it's not too hot out. And that actually helps prevent the ticks from getting underneath your clothing and sort of then attaching. Wearing light colored clothing is helpful because then you're going to recognize the tick more readily. So that's prevention. There are attempts at using sprays in and around yards. That has shown some efficacy, but I think it's relatively costly and you have to balance the environmental impact on that. Checking, making sure that you know, if you've had some prolonged exposure outside, looking at your skin, particularly in areas of your body that you might not be looking at a lot in the course of the day. So checking your back, checking behind your knees, checking around the hairline in your armpits, all these other places where the ticks might be hiding out. So checking to see if there is a tick attached. The good news about Lyme disease in some regards is that the tick has to be attached usually for 48 hours, maybe even longer, for it to actually transmit illness. So finding a tick early on before it's engorged, so swollen up with the blood that it's eating, it usually will prevent the actual infection. And then you can also, most ticks will not be that attached sufficiently to withstand sort of just sort of vigorous washing with hand and with soap and water. So taking a shower when you've had a significant exposure, you know, within a couple hours of being outside can actually help as well. Tick removal is important. So if you do find that a tick is attached, trying to grasp the tick with either a pair of tweezers or some other device, even your fingers in tissue, and making sure that you get that attachment point of the tick and remove that, dispose of it one way or another. What is important there is that if you crush the tick, which usually if they're engorged, you can do that, is to be sure to either be wearing gloves or to wash your hands immediately afterwards. So, you know, those things are all very important, sort of, you know, insect repellents, bright kind of clothing, tucking it in, checking yourself, making sure that there are no ticks attached, and remove them if you find them.
Thank you, Dr. Larkin. And for our listeners who would like to know more about ticks and these infections, you can always visit health.ri.gov/ticks. So that's all the time we have today, Dr. Larkin. And as you know, I could talk all day about ticks, but I do want to send a heartfelt thank you. Thank you for sharing your expertise and your time with us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And for folks that are looking to learn more about Lyme disease, please do check in with your provider. And we also have an excellent infectious diseases team of doctors in the state that are always willing to assist as well. And I speak as one of those infectious diseases docs. In closing, I would also like to thank Erica Collins, our executive producer, and Carol Stone, our technical director. I'm Dr. Philip Chan on behalf of the Rhode Island Department of Health signing off. Thank you all and be well.